Well, as you know, we've been concentrating a lot on the practicalities of living and working in Asia. This week we've had on display possibly our best developed relationship there with Singapore, with the Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong making an official visit, his second, offering proof really of how healthily complex are our national interactions. I was fortunate enough to be a guest at a lunch yesterday in Sydney hosting Mr. Lee, and it was plain to see from the whole event and all the conversations around me just how embedded young Australians and Singaporeans have become. 1 million of us visit the island each year. 300,000 Singaporeans visit Australia. They invest now almost $28 billion here, up from $4 billion 10 years ago. We share a complex military training, for instance. It's a long, long way from Lee Kuan Yew's claim 25 years ago now that we represented the poor white trash of Asia. So here is a relationship conducted at more than merely a trade and strategic level. What, therefore, does it really feel like to people who observe it at close hand? Are many Australians still carrying rather cliched views of this remarkably successful city-state? Well, joining me now to offer some fresh insights, particularly about what's preoccupying modern Singapore, are Hal Hill, the Professor of Southeast Asian Economies with the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University, and Reuben Wong. He's Associate Professor in Political Science at the National University of Singapore. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hello.
Thanks very much, Geraldine.
Professor Wong, at this lunch, the Prime Minister, Mr. Lee, said that Singapore was entering a new phase, a more mature economy. It had its social and demographic problems, but that it really sensed itself in a new phase of its life. Yeah. As a Singaporean, what words would you put to that? Do you agree with him?
Yes, it's a new phase, and it's actually a more challenging and difficult phase because Singapore has reached a level of development where what we used to do, we can't really do anymore in a competitive way. There are too many countries that can do it cheaper and better than us. So we are forced as a country, and our industries are forced to go up the technological and value-added chain.
And he did talk about, I thought, most interestingly, in fact, I cannot really remember an Asian leader doing this in quite the same way, he emphasised the social stresses that he thought were there, that it was harder to establish a consensus as to how to go forward and to bridge the divides that existed. What's that all about?
That's very much in the news in Singapore right now, and it's something that's been coming for the last few years, but really came to a head last year in the general elections in August 2011. And that's because, you know, we have a booming population. I mean, it's a population that's growing not because of natural birth rates, but because we've had to bring in so much talent and labor from abroad. And when you do that, you of course have a lot of social stresses because the infrastructure might not be able to cope, and people need to get used to the idea of having so many foreigners in our midst. And the population has gone up by, I think it was 1 million in the last 10 years. And for a country the size of Singapore, we now have 5.3 million on an area which is 700 square kilometers. I don't know how, you know, big that is compared to islands of Australia, but I can tell you it's a lot smaller than Tasmania.
Yes. And he talked about the other related problems, the demographic problems. I mean, your young people simply aren't having enough children.
Yes, this is something which was reported in the Singapore press as well. I think he spoke to some of the Singapore reporters who went with him to Australia, and the total fertility rate in Singapore is under 1.2.
Wow,
so
that's very low.
It's one of the lowest in the world, and it's, you need 2.1 to be at replacement level. And his goal, I mean, the goal that he suggested was we need to get up to at least 1.4 or 1.5, which is still below replacement level.
He did invoke, he'd been told about Peter Costello's one for dad, one for mum and one for the country. He thought that was rather fun.
That's not going to work in Singapore. And because even if we reach that target of 1.4, 1.5, we've still got to top it up with a net immigration. So this is going to be a continued challenge because we need new immigrants, you know, and I think this is something which Australia can, you know, Australians identify with as well.
Yeah, and just before I go to Professor Hill, I noticed that he said Mr. Lee's government's also strengthening Singapore's social safety nets, although I read in an interview that he's very wary about Western welfareism, through these measures such as workfare and community care. What's that?
It's very interesting because Singapore government is quite allergic to this idea of the welfare state. And it's very taboo. I mean, this is something that nobody wants to talk about. I mean, citizens want to talk about it. Citizens say, you know, you look at Australia, you look at Europe and America, they have better social safety nets than us. I mean, even America has a better social safety net than Singapore. So social spending is very low. We are definitely way below the OECD average. And we don't even have to talk about Europe. But at the same time, the effects of capitalism and the effects of being in such a globalized economy is we effectively have two economies in Singapore. So there's the economy which is doing very well, very globally competitive, and people are earning very high salaries. And there's the economy where people are stuck in low-end jobs and they can't upgrade themselves. And because of that, you know, if we continue doing it, we end up with a very high Gini coefficient.
That, which measures inequality.
Yes, massive inequality. And to ameliorate the potential political problems with this inequality, they've had to come up with policies like workfare, where if you show that you've worked for X number of days in a year, the government tops up your social security account. And, you know, in any other country, we would be calling this welfare provision. But in Singapore, because they're so allergic to this word, we call it workfare. So we give you welfare if you work.
Hal Hill, as a keen observer of Singapore, do you see important shifts here that ought to be noted, particularly about the way immigrants are absorbed into the society?
Well, I suppose Singapore's always been an immigrant society, as Professor Wong, I'm sure, would emphasise also, and it has got one of the highest percentages of foreigners in its workforce. I think it's currently about over 30%. Yeah. So in that sense, both Australia and Singapore, you know, we've got similarities. We've got immigrant communities, but there are a lot of differences as well, and Professor Wong alluded to some of those in the way governments are run, in the attitude towards markets, the attitude towards welfare. They're very different. But what we can always learn from Singapore, I think, is if you look at the international rankings of, you know, various indicators, like who's got the best airport in the world, and as one who goes through Changi Airport regularly, I must say it looks a lot better than Sydney, you know, and who's got the most efficient port. You know, these sort of indicators, we can often benchmark ourselves against Singapore, even though we're, you know, entirely different countries and economies and geographies and histories. Singapore is very good at that benchmark. And it's extremely proactive government on a whole lot of economic and social issues. We can learn from them.
Well, how, for instance, they're much tougher, I read, on asylum seekers and refugees seeking to arrive on their shores. How would you characterise that aspect of their the way they sit in the region?
Well, I think we have to understand, crucially, Singapore's sort of geostrategic view of the world, and I can't pretend to claim I can fully articulate it, but it's the key is this sense of still of vulnerability, this you know, 5 million people on the little red dot, as it were, the former Indonesian President Habibie referred to it as that, surrounded by this 250 million sort of Malay Muslim world. This is a caricature, but it's a key feature. I mean, they're still importing water from Malaysia, and every now and again Malaysia threatens to cut it off. And they've got a very high defence expenditure, and that's because of that sort of sense of vulnerability in the region. So clearly on asylum seekers, I mean, they have no truck with it. There's no possibility for any asylum seekers landing in Singapore.
What happens to them?
Well, they get quickly sent off and sometimes, you know, treated rather brutally. So, you know, the message is very clear. Don't go near Singapore if you're an asylum seeker. Yeah. Of course, they have very open migration policy, but very tough on asylum seeking. And, of course, you know, that's the difference between the two countries. They see us as this huge, underpopulated, resource-rich country. You don't have to work very hard. And they have to, you know, they've got no natural resources and they have to work extremely hard to maintain their wealth. I'm oversimplifying, of course, but that's the sort of gist of it, I think.
Yes.
Incidentally, Lee Kuan Yew also called us once meaner than the meanest of Europeans. So he's every now and again taking pot shots at it, not just the white trash.
Now, if you're speaking of sort of big generalisations, I think many Australians, maybe people, not people who visited there recently, but have a view of Singapore as an extremely locked down, sort of authoritarian society. And for instance, it blocked the YouTube broadcasting that the Muslim cartoons film, which caused such a problem in the rest of the world. So Hal Hill, how would you describe the current state of openness within very modern Singapore?
Well, a social commentator once described it as a bit like a sort of a strict 1930s British boarding school. Now, that's a bit tough, I think. I think it noticeably over the last decade, it has become a good deal freer. But of course, it is, I think it's the case that the PAP, the People's Action Party, is actually the longest running governing party, perhaps apart from Malaysia, of any quasi-democracy. So it's effectively been a one-party state in a sense. And of course, it's, you know, it's a very tough government. It doesn't really brook a lot of dissent outside of the normal bounds of discourse where they encourage, you know, intelligent conversations as they see it. So, you know, it's a very different kind of political structure and political economy to our kind of freewheeling, exuberant democracy, you might say. And the other point is that just, you know, the neighbourhood does differ a lot. I mean, we are conscious of our proximity to Indonesia, but of course, in Singapore, you can actually stand on the port and you can see Indonesia. So, you know, it's just a very different kind of geostrategic view, I guess.
Well, indeed, that was discussed at the lunch with Prime Minister Lee, Dr. Wong, and attitudes to China and to the South China Sea and the shared strategic interests between Australia and Singapore. But how would you describe the sort of conversations that take place in Singapore about this constant and ongoing rise of China?
China is always a difficult and tricky issue, I think, for any country in Asia and even for the U.S. And China is of course, in some ways, even trickier for Singapore. And Singapore is because we're talking about a country where 70-75% of the population are ethnic Chinese, and many of the new immigrants, the new Singaporeans, are from China. So you have basically old ethnic Chinese Singaporeans and new Chinese Singaporeans who might be straight from the mainland, and they're quite different. So, you know, the attitudes towards China are also quite varied. You know, there are the older Singaporeans who see themselves as Singaporeans, you know, that they were part of the British Empire, they're part of the Commonwealth, they're in the English-speaking world. They're also in the Chinese-speaking world. So sometimes there's a bit of schizophrenia, and our worst nightmare is to be caught between the US and China.
Well, so it's ours too.
Yeah, exactly.
The perception is that you're handling it a little bit better than us. I don't know whether that's even right, but particularly, say, what about the rise of nationalism, which I know occupies the attention of strategic planners in Singapore, you know, both in Japan and in China. You can't look on that with equanimity, I wouldn't have thought.
Yes. I think luckily for us, Singapore is not one of the claimants in the South China Sea Spratly dispute. So we have nothing to haggle or to bargain with China over. But we're very concerned because China is in many ways driving a wedge between Southeast Asian countries, you know, over this very dispute. And we saw, for example, in July, the very first time in ASEAN's 40-over-year history that ASEAN failed to issue a chairman's.
This was in their last meeting in Cambodia.
At the last meeting, yes, in Cambodia. That was because there are certain Southeast Asian countries which are a bit closer to China than we would be happy with. And Singapore, in a sense, we are close to China, and we know culturally we are very close to China. But we have a geopolitical stance which is different from that of China, and we don't like it, and we're uncomfortable when we see some of our neighbors, in a sense, caving into Chinese demands. So we like to see a strong ASEAN as well, and although we're comfortable with China, we would like to see a continued U.S. presence, and I think in that regard, we see geopolitical trends in Southeast Asia, and our wishes are very close to that of Australia's.
And just before I let you go, I'm told there's a whole new downtown that everyone can see, which is really a massive casino, which you've reclaimed land. That, gee, that's not the Singapore that Australians knew of old.
Well, you know, there are, I understand there are over 20,000 Australians living in Singapore now. And, you know, what you're talking about is the Marina Bay area. So there's a huge casino there, and it's part of the Formula One race track. Is, you know, it runs through that area as well. So yeah, you're right. You know, it's a Singapore which is a bit more freewheeling than before. There are more freedoms from everything to do with gambling to alcohol to entertainment, right down to freedom of expression. You know, even that is not sacrosanct anymore. This idea that the government has the final say.
All right.
So it's opening up. It's probably a lot more open than Professor Hill might remember. You know, I'm sure he's been studying Singapore for many years, but the last few years has been an explosion of new things happening.
Thank you very much indeed, Hal Hill and Reuben Wong, for joining us.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And Hal Hill is at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the ANU. Reuben Wong, Associate Professor in Political Science at the National University of Singapore. And I'd very much, I know we're listened to quite a lot in Singapore, and I'd very much like to hear from Singaporean residents, expats and Singaporeans, on some of those insights offered there, because it certainly does make interesting reading, modern Singapore, and maybe with luck we might even get there in the coming year.